a data analytics company found, when they tested using sign up with your Google account as the one and only call to action on their homepage. There was no option to enter an email address and password. It was connect with your Google account or nothing. And seemingly overnight, co-founder Neil Patel reported their signups increased a stunning 59.4%. But as we cautioned earlier, what works for one product may not work at all for others, which is why, as tempting as it may be to make this change, you've got to test it first. At Inman, when my team experimented with removing our single sign-on, we saw conversions increase 24.8%. It turns out that one size does not fit all when it comes to growth hacks. Flipping the funnel. A particularly bold way to reduce the friction keeping your customers from experiencing the aha moment quickly is to flip the funnel, meaning to allow visitors to start experiencing the joys of your product before asking them to sign up. Hello Bar, a tool that makes it easy for web marketing teams to display important, short-term messages to their website visitors, used this tactic to achieve a big win in increasing activation. They let their users simply create their Hello Bar message first, and then once it was ready to go, that is, after the user had already invested time in creating and customizing their first one, the company asked for the sign-up. Activation increased by 52.11%. Similarly, Stripe, an online payments company, allows its customers to grab a small snippet of code and start using it right away, only asking for account details when it's time to transact with real money. This gets more of their potential customers experimenting with their product and experiencing the aha moment before they commit to creating an account. And this technique works just as well for non-web products. Warby Parker, the trendy eyeglass brand, will send anyone a set of 5 frames before making a purchase to help users decide which ones they like before they have to commit to a particular pair. Each of these companies flips some critical part of the typical funnel and eliminates friction in the process. Optimizing is a push and pull with friction. Often, in trying to improve activation of new users, you may have to add some friction in order to direct them to take the next steps. A great example of how to strike this delicate balance between leading customers through a process that will ultimately lead to activation and not creating so much extra work as to turn them away is a set of experiments that Airbnb ran upon noticing in its data that most visitors who signed up did so only at the very last moment when they were ready to go ahead and book a room. The team wanted to get people to become active earlier than that, when they were merely browsing rooms, so they could learn about them and the kinds of locations and rooms they would be most interested in. That way, the team could work on ways of better tailoring the properties shown to people when they ultimately searched with the intention of booking, which, the team expected, would increase the booking rate and overall satisfaction of using Airbnb. The team started with a very lightweight and somewhat rough experiment. Remember, when prioritizing which experiments to run, it pays to start small. By adding a prominent strip across the bottom of the website with a small bit of text explaining the benefits of signing up. If a visitor ignored that call to action, she would be shown another sign-up prompt on the next page she went to, and on each subsequent page. The results of the first experiment were intriguing. They saw a good uptick in sign-ups, but also a drop-off in bookings. The prompts seemed to be causing friction that stopped some people from proceeding to search and book. But as they analyzed the data further, they saw that the increased signups led to many valuable payoffs, such as more invites sent out to potential new users, and new users adding more properties to a wish list feature, thus providing more information about users' desired bookings. So the team decided to next experiment with reducing the friction of the prompts in an attempt to find the best of both worlds, more signups and more bookings. They focused on optimizing how they displayed the prompts, including their design and the frequency with which they appeared. In one experiment, instead of showing the signup prompt on every page, they dropped the frequency to every 5 pages a visitor viewed. By changing the rate at which they prompted users to sign up, they lost just 4% on the improved signup rate and entirely eliminated the negative impact on bookings. The team also tested adding more text around the call to action to encourage signups, inserting a testimonial from a happy Airbnb customer, as well as some text about the value of signing up. Here, they got a real surprise. They found that adding this additional text actually hurt signups, and they reasoned that was because it actually distracted users. This is an example of a more subtle type of friction, which isn't actually experienced as annoying, yet still deters visitors or users from taking the action you want them to. You can really only discover whether this kind of friction exists and how it is impacting your activation rates through experimentation. The Airbnb team ran many more experiments in order to optimize this experience, testing all of the design of the elements in the signup prompts, from the color of the signup bar on the homepage to the styling of the buttons on the signup form, and eventually found the sweet spot for improving the company's overall signup rate and other important metrics. The power of positive friction. One of the great ironies of improving activation is that not all friction is bad. Dumping people with no context or clue right into your product as fast as possible is not always optimal. Sometimes you want to put some positive friction in their way. Creating positive friction is a delicate art of putting manageable, ideally engaging steps in the path of visitors that help them understand what the value is and get to the aha moment with greater predictability. Video game developers have honed the practice to a level of perfection. They face a particular challenge in getting users hooked on new games because the rules of games must be introduced. After all, users will never get to the aha moment, the joy of playing, if they don't know how to be successful in the game. And in many cases, the rules and the strategies for play are quite complicated. To solve the problem, developers drew on insights from psychological research to craft marvelously enticing introductions to gameplay. One of the key findings they drew on was introduced by psychologist Robert Cialdini in his business classic, Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion. In a number of studies he references, it was discovered that once people take an action, no matter how small, as long as the experience wasn't onerous, they are more inclined to take any action in the future. The explanation for this, he says, is that they have made a form of psychological commitment by taking the action, and people have a bias for honoring commitments with subsequent follow-on actions, often regardless of the change in size of request. Game designers shrewdly realized that rather than providing instructions about how to play a game, they had to get people committed. They had to get them to start playing through small, easy steps to get them oriented and rolling. Game developers draw on many other powerful insights from psychology as well. One is the well-established principle of conditioning people to engage in behaviors by offering them rewards. The other is taking advantage of the enormous satisfaction people feel when they are in the brain state known as flow, a theory pioneered by psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who showed that people get into this optimal state when they feel challenged just the right amount by a task they are engaged in. Not so challenged as to feel frustrated, yet challenged enough so as not to feel bored. People who are in flow are so engaged that they lose track of time. 3 hours working on a painting, or on writing an essay, or coding an app, can feel like much less, and people will look up from their work shocked by the time that's passed. Anyone who's ever been told by someone playing a video game, "Just give me 10 more minutes," then another 10 minutes, then another 10 minutes, knows how easily game players tend to get into flow. Game designers combine this wisdom to craft new user experiences that lead people gently into playing their games, starting with simple challenges that can be mastered quickly, and providing them with rewards for each hurdle cleared, while orienting them to the rules of the game and the environment in the process. They then ratchet up the level of challenge, as well as the degree of reward, in exquisitely refined increments, both of which they experiment a great deal with, so that users are hooked and get into flow. And this doesn't just work for video games. Designers of many other types of online products have incorporated similar tactics to create new user experiences that greatly increase activation rates, tailoring a set of actions for users to engage in that show them how the product works, and then providing some kind of reward for doing so. For example, when Facebook prompts new users to fill out their profile, add a photo of themselves and some biographical information, they are not just gathering personal data that is valuable for analysis and for selling advertising, though those things are true also. They are establishing commitment. "Since I already spent all this time picking out a picture and drafting my bio," we think, "I might as well keep going." And providing a psychological reward, the satisfaction of a completed profile. And as anyone who has spent hours crafting their Facebook profile knows, there is something about this process that provides an utterly satisfying state of flow. In the process, Facebook brings people closer to discovering the aha moment, because the core value of the site is based on people finding their friends, which they can only do once everyone has filled out their profile. The more information people put into the product, the more their commitment increases, through a concept called stored value. Much like putting money in a safe deposit box, putting information into a service instantly creates a sense of ownership for users and an inclination to commitment to add to and maintain that value. So while prompts for information can be a source of friction, if done properly, i.e. in a way that is rewarding and through actions that slowly increase the level of commitment, they can also be a catalyst for activation and growth. Crafting a learn flow. While the new user experience is ripe for friction, it is ripe for opportunity as well. That's because the first experience people have with your product is also the time that they are most consciously trying to figure it out. As former head of growth for Twitter, Josh Ellman, who we met earlier, says about the new user experience, "This is your moment. You have more attention than you ever will have again from that user to try to teach them what your product is really about, to really help them learn the product in a meaningful way." Ellman's team designed something he dubbed the Learn Flow to enable Twitter to take advantage of this attention. Learn Flow is Ellman's definition of a new user experience that's designed to more than just sign people up, but rather purposefully educates new users about the product, its benefits and value, and how to use it in the process. This Nux design takes advantage of the abundance of attention and patience new users credit you in that first visit to make sure they're primed for activation by the time they finish. For Twitter, this involved not only creating a new account, but also showing new users what Twitter was all about in the first place. They designed a learn flow that showed users how the Twitter timeline worked, suggested categories to follow, such as fashion, sports, and news, prompted people to follow notable accounts, and then to complete their profile. By the end of this learn flow, not only are you all signed up for the service, you've customized your profile, and you have a Twitter feed full of news you care about. In one visit, Twitter got you to commit to the service experience the aha moment, and build stored value. Not bad for one visit. Of course, because Twitter was offering such a novel service, one that required people to adopt a new habit, teaching them about the value of following people and how to use Twitter was not optional. For some products, no such explanation is needed. For e-commerce sites, for example, people generally just really want to start browsing for goods as fast as possible, and most often have a good idea of what they're shopping for. So just about any effort to get people to move through some kind of orchestrated process will be resented. For yet other products, the judgment call about whether or not to require some of a user's time to go through a set of steps is harder to make. Because while they may be able to make a rough assumption about how to use the product, getting some information from them and showing them some aspects of the way the product works as it relates specifically to them can enhance their appreciation of its value. Making this call, of course, requires experimentation. Pinterest is a great case of this. Just as Twitter had to educate people about what a tweet was exactly, and what this foreign process of tweeting entailed, Pinterest, too, had to introduce users to the novel concept of pins and show users how to create them. The growth team worked hard on educating new users through three mobile Learn Flow screens that showed how to discover pinned content, how to add their own pins, and how to create boards, collections of items that users create to store and share pins. After going through those three screens, new users were delivered a stream of the most popular content on Pinterest, and from that point, were on their own. By all accounts, a solid first user experience. Yet in exemplary growth hacking fashion, the team decided to experiment with improving it even more. They realized that the most popular content wasn't always relevant to any given user. So they decided to test a more personalized new user experience on the mobile app. Now users were first shown just one screen, which asked them to select five topics that they were interested in following, such as camping, weddings, motorsports, and home decor. After they made their selections, the app delivered them to a feed made up solely of that type of content, where they could practice pinning and saving items. The change resulted in a 20% increase in activation rate. A massive win. If you do decide to introduce some positive friction, there are two additional tactics in particular that have proven quite successful. Questionnaires and gamifying the new user experience. The art of the questionnaire. Neil Patel, a leading expert in growth hacking, has highlighted the effectiveness of asking users a set of questions as you greet them. These should be questions that are clearly asked in the interest of serving the user better, almost like a mini questionnaire. A great example, Patel notes, is a questionnaire that online golfing retailer Revolution Golf ask users to fill in as part of the sign-up process, and one that the company credits with gains in activation that helped it reach $20 million in annual revenue. It asks questions such as a visitor's gender, age, average driving distance, average score for 18 holes, and biggest problems with their swing. When Patel tested similar questionnaires with Hello Bar, which he owns, he was able to increase the number of leads generated by 281%. Asking customers about their interests or about the problems they are seeking solutions for immediately creates a form of commitment, as they must invest a little time in responding, while at the same time they have forged a deeper personal connection with you and your product. It also conveys to them that you are interested in them individually and in providing the best service for them you can. And as with Pinterest's method of onboarding users by showing them pins of particular personal interest, it also allows you to start customizing their experience of your product as part of their first exposure. The tactic works best if it's clear to the customer that customizing the product to their needs and desires will be to their advantage. In an era when people are becoming increasingly fearful of big data, or as some think of it, Big Brother, customization is not always a plus. For example, when people learn that Google was customizing search results according to a complex algorithm that factored in lots of information about the searcher from prior search history, many people were put off, and the company received lots of criticism in the press. A key caution here is that you also don't want to ask too many questions. Patel recommends no more than 5, and making them multiple choice rather than open-ended, with no more than 4 possible answers each. Including images and visuals will also likely improve engagement. And as with all hacks, these mini questionnaires should be put through the process of rigorous experimentation. Gamification, pros and cons. Gamification is, in essence, offering rewards, such as perks and benefits not available to all people, to customers for taking certain actions. Adobe, for example, used gamification in their activation hacking to increase the number of people who took a free trial of Adobe Photoshop and then purchased the product. The company launched Level Up for Photoshop, which was a new user experience that turned boring tutorials into missions for trial users to complete. The missions helped the trial customers learn the most powerful benefits of the software and showed them how to make the most of it. They added incentives for completing missions and new levels that could only be unlocked by completing other tasks. Adobe saw a 4x increase in trial to purchase from the effort. By adding a pleasing element of challenge and fun, and also offering meaningful rewards, gamification can be a powerful activation tool. But it can also backfire. If rewards offer no value, or value that has little relevance to the core value experienced by users, i.e., don't achieve product incentive fit, then the tactic can come across as blatantly manipulative, or just downright strange. That was true for a gamification effort that online shoe retailer Zappos launched for their VIP program. The company was trying to create a new level of higher frequency shoppers. They tried to gamify the shopping experience by offering badges for doing things like favoriting a shoe model and buying multiple pairs. But the badges offered no value, no higher discounts or other benefits, and left customers confused, leading Zappos to ultimately shutter the effort. Brian Wong, founder of Keep, a company that helps mobile apps provide rewards to their users, says that gamification should be thought of as a toolkit of options to choose from, rather than a predefined set of tactics that work for all businesses. What you choose to deploy can range from subtle to more overt. As with anything, you've got to experiment with what will be best for your product and customers. He suggests focusing on 3 main aspects of any gamification effort. Meaningful rewards, creating surprise and delight by varying how rewards are earned and presented, and providing some element of instant gratification. Beyond assuring the relevance of rewards is clear, and that they are actually of value to users, there are few hard and fast rules about what perks to offer. LinkedIn gamifies in a gentle fashion, including a progress meter on people's profile pages that shows them how complete their profiles are, nudging them to fill in more information. This offers the reward of the instant satisfaction of a completed profile and receiving the implicit approval by those who view it. Khan Academy, an online education website, takes the more overt approach of offering points and awards as users take more courses, creating surprise and delight with rewards as users hit new milestones. The company is careful, though, not to make these the centerpiece of its user experience, as they are aware that such explicit rewards can undermine the actual intrinsic reward of skills acquisition that is offered by learning. On the very overt side of the spectrum, our loyalty programs employed by businesses ranging from Starbucks to credit cards to restaurants. Gabe Zickerman, a leading gamification expert, has identified that the most effective rewards in a gamified setting come in the form of status, access, power, and stuff. Stuff being financial incentives or physical gifts. Credit cards, such as American Express membership rewards, deploy all of these elements, from new levels of status to achieve through spending, power and access to special events and travel opportunities, and of course free stuff, which can be redeemed with the points earned. Similarly, the Starbucks reward program boasts more than 12 million members who use a Starbucks gift card or the company's mobile app to earn stars each time they buy a cup of coffee. Those stars turn into more free coffee and other Starbucks merchandise. The more stars they earn, the bigger rewards they can redeem, and they also move up in rank, accumulating more status as a member of the Starbucks faithful. The program has been so successful that the company now has more than $1 billion in customer cash from the preloaded gift cards and app. Ins and outs of triggers. While gamification doesn't work for every situation, triggers are everywhere. And even more so than gamification, the use of triggers to stoke activation requires careful consideration to get it right. Triggers are any sort of prompt that provokes a response from people, common ones being email notifications, mobile push notifications, and less obtrusively, calls to action on a landing page. There is no denying that triggers are one of the most powerful tactics for increasing the use of your product. But for every benefit, there are plenty of potential pitfalls. We're targets of so many triggers these days, from Facebook notifications that a friend has liked a photo, to LinkedIn emails about a new connection request, and Amazon updates about the delivery status of a package, that it's easy to cross the line from helpful to annoying. Who hasn't been utterly infuriated by the desperation of a steady drip of email messages hollering, "Come back! Are you sure you don't want to come back? We'd really love to see you come back!" Often, they come from a company whose product we long ago dismissed, making them look even more irritating, while at the same time making the company look desperate. So you want to tread lightly with triggers, experimenting with great care. The power of triggers comes from two key factors: how much they motivate users to take the action you want them to, and how easy it is for users to do so at the time they receive the trigger. BJ Fogg, a psychology researcher at Stanford, developed a useful model for thinking about how to make triggers effective. Nir Eyal, the author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, helpfully uses the scenario of receiving a phone call to illustrate. Whether you answer a call is dependent on whether the phone is handy and you're free to take it, your ability, as well as on motivating factors, such as whether you know the name of the caller, wish to talk to him or her, or perhaps need some information that he or she possesses. The trigger in this case is clearly the phone ringing. If you hear it ring when you're motivated and available, you'll answer. Because triggers can be so invasive, you want to be judicious in how you use them and experiment in measured steps. Making matters more complicated, you've also got to follow some rules dictated by the platform on which you wish to deliver them. For example, mobile push notification rules differ for Apple phones than for those that run on Android. Whereas Apple users need to opt in to receive notifications, Android users are opted in to get notifications by default. Rules have also been established in consumer protection law for sending emails, such as the CAN-SPAM law in the United States. And finally, for opt-in notifications, a trigger's impact will vary greatly depending on how many users agree to receive them. The range of opt-in agreement can vary a great deal across products and product categories. For example, For mobile notifications, opt-in rates range from 80% at the high end, for services like ride-sharing, to 39% at the low end, for news and media offerings, according to Kahuna, a mobile messaging company. One of the biggest mistakes companies make is asking visitors to opt in to receiving triggers, such as notifications and emails, too soon, often as a necessary first step to setting up or accessing the product. This can scare people off, because they have no idea, or only a vague inkling yet, about why they would want these messages. Many companies also abuse triggers in an attempt to gin up their product use statistics, a move that may make their short-term activation stats look pretty, but does nothing to create long-term use, often in fact having a negative effect as people tune out, turn off notifications, or delete the app. A great rule of thumb about deploying triggers is that your rationale for getting in touch with the users should be to alert them of an opportunity of clear value to them. For example, the grocery app team could send notifications when an item that a person has saved in their shopping list goes on sale, or when there's a special offer on free delivery, or when the chain is running a Thanksgiving holiday promotion. These types of triggers would make sense to users because they relate to the core value of the shopping app. However, sending notifications weekly about new sales or product features that aren't particularly relevant to customers might quickly irritate them and prompt many of them to disable notifications or delete the app from their phones altogether. In experimenting with different trigger notifications, it's important to keep some users in what's called a holdout group, which is subject to none of the experiments. This assures that you can compare not only the effect of new triggers, but the effect of using none of them as well. Some common types of notification triggers to experiment with are account creation. Encourage users who have downloaded an app or visited a retail website to complete their account. Purchase messages. Encourage users to make a purchase with a short-term discount. Reactivation campaign. Encourage users who haven't been to your site or app in a while to come back and re-engage. New feature announcement. Share the news about updates to the product. Top user incentives. For heavy users of the product, let them know they're special and encourage greater affinity and use. Activity or status change, such as a friend taking an action or an item in your shopping cart changing price. You can, of course, invent your own types of triggers as well. In coming up with ideas, it's helpful to know about a categorization of the types of triggers that BJ Fogg introduced. He divides them into three basic types, based on the motivation and ability level of the user. A facilitator trigger, which helps those with high motivation but low ability take action. A signal trigger, which helps keep people with high motivation and high ability headed in the right direction and encourages repeat action. And a spark, which spurs people with high ability yet low motivation to take action. Many email and mobile notifications fall into the spark category, but they shouldn't be the only ones considered. The grocery app team, for example, might devise a facilitator trigger that pops up after a certain amount of time that a user has been on the checkout page without completing the purchase, asking if they'd like to have the credit card that was used before be used for this purchase. They might also experiment with a signal trigger, which could be a message on screen that notifies a user about how much he's saving by having made a set of purchases. A spark trigger they might try out would be offering an especially high discount on a favorite item of a shopper who has logged in but hasn't moved any items into her cart after a certain period, to try to spark that first critical purchase. In crafting triggers to try out, the set of six principles of persuasion that Robert Cialdini presents in his book Influence are also invaluable. We mentioned one earlier in discussing his insight that once people take an action of whatever kind, they are more inclined to take that action again. Here is the full set. Reciprocity, whereby people are more likely to do something in return of a favor, regardless of the favor done and the ask now presented to them. Commitment and consistency. People who have taken one action are likely to take another, regardless of the size or difference in action. Social proof. In a state of uncertainty, people look to the actions of others to help them make their own decisions. Authority. People look to those in the position of authority to decide which actions to take. Liking. People will do business more readily with people and companies they like over those they don't or are indifferent to. Scarcity. People will take action when they are worried that they will miss out on the opportunity in the future. A trigger can draw on the principle of reciprocity by offering users a free resource, such as a downloadable white paper or free shipping. HubSpot's website grader is a great example. A case of using the principle of consistency and commitment is the way in which the Obama presidential campaign team broke down the donation request form on its website into a series of smaller steps, rather than having all of them appearing on one page. Having taken the first small step, users were more inclined to take the rest, which led to a 5% increase in the rate at which people responded with donations, and millions of additional dollars in the campaign fund. Triggers can incorporate the principle of authority by showcasing that influential people or companies have taken the action they're urging users to take, which is, of course, the rationale of celebrity endorsements. Including the logos of well-respected companies that have used a service or testimonials from respected individuals can also act as triggers by reassuring the visitor that people and companies they know and respect have made a similar decision. Lots of triggers make use of the principle of liking, such as the messages sent by Airbnb with the name of a friend who referred you to the service, or Nasty Gal, where founder Sophia Amoruso tracked which models customers responded to best, i.e., who seemed to sell the most merchandise, and paired them with items that needed a boost in sales. All of us have surely received some notifications that draw on the principle of scarcity, warning us, for example, that a sale is about to end, or that there are only a few tickets left for the show or concert we were thinking of attending, or only a few seats left on a flight we were thinking of booking. Booking.com makes great use of this tactic, showing all browsers the number of people actively looking at hotel rooms in the same search area and the number left on the site. Amazon, too, shows browsers how many items are left when inventory is low, trying to spur them to go ahead and purchase. The final and most powerful type of trigger is the internal type, which occurs involuntarily within your customers. These are at the core of habits and spur long-term use. Few of us need any external trigger to visit Facebook or Instagram. We do it on our own volition now. The same could be said for our favorite clothing retailer, whose website we routinely check for new sales or inventory, the news source we visit every morning, or the convenience store we always stop at to grab coffee on the way to work. No matter what your product is, these habits are at the foundation of strong relationships with your customers. So we'll revisit them and some more nuances about them in the following chapters. The bottom line is, do experiment with triggers, because they can be extraordinarily effective. But do so with a very thoughtful understanding of how they can actually be of service to your users. Otherwise, rather than activating users and starting to build a good relationship with them, you are almost sure to push them away. Now, speaking of building relationships with your customers, let's move farther through the user experience to examine how growth teams have used the growth hacking process to achieve great successes in retention. Chapter 7, Hacking Retention. Legendary business expert Peter Drucker famously wrote many years ago that the purpose of business is to create and keep a customer. But even though no one would argue with the famous business maxim, the fact is that for most businesses, the rate of customer churn, the rate of loss of new users, is appalling. This is unfortunate because high retention is generally the deciding factor in achieving strong profitability for any kind of company. As we mentioned briefly in Chapter 4, widely cited research by Frederick Reichheld of Bain & Company has shown that a 5% increase in customer retention rates increases profits by anywhere from 25 to 95%. The flip side is that losing customers comes at great cost. One reason is that, as we learned in Chapter 5, it takes so much money to acquire a new customer, especially at a time when advertising costs are skyrocketing due to a surge in competition for prime online real estate. And the more you have to spend upfront to attract new customers, the more costly the loss of each customer becomes, making retaining customers that much more essential, both for recouping your spending on expensive ad campaigns and for preventing customers from defecting to the competition. HomeJoy, a home cleaning startup, once had a bright future, raising more than $64 million from some of Silicon Valley's best investors. But the company is a prime example of the danger of poor retention. Despite having attracted an impressive number of initial customers through an aggressive promotional discounting strategy, HomeJoy failed to live up to its promise, delivering service that customers described as hit or miss. In addition, many customers couldn't swallow a steep jump in price from a promotional first cleaning at a special discounted price to the regular price for the service, the result being that only 15 to 20% of customers ended up ordering a second cleaning. Meanwhile, HomeJoy's competitors were achieving retention rates double those numbers. Making matters still worse, the company had spent heavily on customer acquisition. This combination of high acquisition costs and low retention led to its rapid demise. Amazon, in contrast, is perhaps the gold standard example of retention prowess. The company's subscription program, Amazon Prime, has been a particular triumph in retaining customers, largely due to the two-day free shipping included on thousands of items, but also many ancillary benefits that have been added to the program, such as its video and music streaming services. 73% of free trial subscribers convert to paying subscribers, and 91% of first-year subscribers renew for a second year. What's even more impressive is that retention continues to increase the longer customers have been subscribers, with the renewal rate for customers heading into their third year in the program at an almost unheard-of high of 96%. The compounding value of retention. It should go without saying that the longer you retain customers, the more opportunity you have to earn more revenue from them, whether that's from selling them more items or services, from ongoing subscription renewals, or from bringing in more advertising revenue due to advertisers wanting to target your large and loyal customer base. If you consider the fact that subscribers in Amazon's Prime program purchase more than twice as much as non-Prime members, it becomes easy to imagine the compounding gains in revenue one can see from high retention rates. In fact, some analysts believe that without Amazon Prime, the company would not be profitable. Increasing the average revenue you earn per customer in turn allows you to invest more in growth, creating a virtuous cycle. This is both because strong retention generates higher current earnings and because it allows you to predict better that your future earnings will be strong. Amazon's reliable earnings per subscriber have allowed the company to invest significantly in continuing to build up the Prime program, such as by adding original programming to its video streaming service. The longer you retain customers, the more you can learn about them and their needs and desires, and thus the better you can tailor services and promotions to them, which of course allows you to earn more from them. When Amazon launched Prime, some analysts argued that the company would be spending too much on free two-day shipping and discounts for Prime-eligible items, and therefore the program would be unsustainable. But Amazon saw that with so many subscribers renewing and spending far above average, the program was on a highly profitable trajectory. Yet another benefit of higher retention is that it allows you to see stronger results from both word of mouth and your viral marketing efforts. Because the longer users stay with your product, the more opportunities they'll have to talk about it and even show it to friends and others. Homing in on best bets fast. Given the increasingly high costs of customer acquisition and the ever more heated competition most businesses are up against these days, it's vital that companies are attuned to problems with their customer retention and work to stop defections, or what marketers call churn, as early as possible. Growth hacking is the ideal means of achieving this. To give just a quick example, let's return to the grocery app team. What if, by keeping close track of customer data, the team identifies a slide in usage by a large number of customers after the first month or so of use, a fate far too familiar for mobile apps? Where should they begin trying to get more customers to stay actively engaged in using the app? Should the team increase the number of mobile notifications it sends to users to entice them to come back? Should they offer special pricing and savings available only within the app on popular items? Perhaps they should build some new features, like the successful shopping list, to increase the utility of the app. All of these ideas might work, but they all involve significant costs. And in addition, the team must be sensitive about not annoying users with too many promotional messages or triggers. As discussed in the last chapter, more mobile notifications could spur short-term use, but might quickly lose their luster as people tired of the interruptions. In-app promotions might lead to increased purchasing by loyal app shoppers, but not reach most of the customers the team wants to re-engage, because those people aren't on the app much, if at all. Building new features is expensive, and there's no guarantee that users will become more regularly active and for the longer term due to them. Growth hacking allows teams to quickly choose which out of such a set of ideas to start testing first and rapidly produce results that clarify how to move forward. The grocery app team could easily test all three of these ideas in short order. The email notifications and app promotions are a snap to create, and an idea for a new feature can be rapidly tested by surveying customers about how appealing it would be to them, or building a quick prototype to test with a set of users. Perhaps they would decide to experiment first with sending more email notifications. And within only a few weeks, they might be able to learn that sending one additional mobile notification per week led to only 10% of lapsed users returning to the app. But that if two more notifications were sent in a week, 35% of them returned. They might then go ahead and schedule sending the two additional notifications to all lapsed users the next week. Meanwhile, the responses to the new feature prototype might be so positive that the team could convince the product development group to fast-track work on it, and that might begin to improve retention shortly after it's introduced. These results would, of course, only be the beginning of non-stop crafting and testing of hacks to boost retention, the topic of this chapter. What drives retention? Before we get into more specifics about how to apply the growth hacking process to improve retention, it's important to return to a brief consideration of the basics of what builds customer loyalty and keeps customers coming back. As discussed in Chapter 2, retaining customers most fundamentally depends upon providing them with a product or service of high quality that continually addresses a need of theirs, or perhaps simply delights them, and which they come to regard as a must-have. We also discussed there that a great measure of having achieved product-market fit is a stable retention curve. Now, in focusing on hacking retention, we will look closely at what growth teams should be doing to assure that retention at the very least remains stable, or ideally, how they can work to increase retention from that baseline over time. First, it's important to highlight that even after having initially achieved a stable retention curve, a company may begin to see its retention erode for various reasons. Perhaps a competitive product has come out and is stealing users away. Or perhaps an existing competitor has launched a new feature or promotion that has the same effect. Another key reason customers defect over time is that a company is not communicating with them optimally. The company hasn't found the right sorts of messages to be sending to them, with the right frequency, to keep the app top of mind, leaving them ripe for the picking by competitors. Companies may also be failing to take advantage of opportunities to build loyalty by working to create a regular habit or strong feeling in customers that they are appreciated and understood. Or perhaps the need the company fills is no longer an urgent one for its customers, or is being fulfilled in a way that is more satisfying or convenient, as might happen when the technology in the product has become outdated or obsolete. Growth teams are perfectly equipped to look for early warning signs of erosion and retention. But they shouldn't stop there. Teams ought to apply the rapid experimentation process to pushing retention higher and higher, as Amazon has achieved with its Prime subscribers. A stable curve is by no means the be-all and end-all of retention. Evernote calls its retention graph a smile graph, because the longer people use Evernote, the more likely they are to continue using it. Evernote's retention graph looks that way essentially because the service's usefulness improves over time. The core value is enhanced the longer you use Evernote, because as a note-keeping product, the more information that is saved within it, the more likely people are to return to access those ideas and notes and add more to them. Many successful digital products achieve a growing retention rate over time. Whether it's for Instagram, which becomes more valuable the more photos you post and people you follow, or a business product, such as QuickBooks, which gets more valuable to the company the more financial data stored within it, which, remember, is referred to as stored value. Companies with the opportunity to capitalize on the power of stored value have an advantage in increasing retention over time. But no company, even those with this built-in opportunity, can simply assume that customers will continue to be actively engaged. They must steadily work to improve their offerings for customers. Just think about how many new features and services Facebook has offered since its launch, and how many different kinds of notifications and prompts they've devised to keep you using the service. From adding live video and slideshows, to prompting you to share news about your favorite sports teams, or letting you know when you have a Facebook anniversary with a friend. The company continually works to improve how engaged and retained its customer base is. Any kind of company can and should work to keep increasing the value it's delivering to customers and their level of engagement over time. The three phases of retention. The methods for retaining users evolve according to the phase of retention the user is in. Brian Balfour, whom we've met earlier, highlights that retention breaks down into three phases: initial, medium, and long term. The initial retention period is the critical time during which a new user either becomes convinced to keep using or buying a product or service, or goes dormant after one or a few visits. Think of the initial retention rate as a measure of the immediate stickiness of the product. There is no fixed definition of the initial retention period. It might be as short as a day for a mobile app or a week or two for a social network. For a software as a service or SaaS product, the initial retention period might be more like a month or quarter, whereas for e-commerce companies, it is often the first 90 days. You should determine this period for your product based on both the data you can get about the standards for products of your type across the sector you're in, and by your own analysis of the behavior of your own customers over time. The good news about this period is that research shows that users who get more value from a product during the initial period of use are more likely to stick around longer term. Also, generally, there's lots of opportunity to improve the user's experience in this phase. This was the main impetus behind the start of the growth team at HubSpot. As explained by co-founder and CTO Dharmesh Shah, the reason we decided to kick off a growth team in the first place was that we felt there was a lot of low-hanging fruit in our trials and onboarding process. We covered the work of the HubSpot team in improving its onboarding process in the activation chapter, and this initial retention phase is essentially an extension of activation. Think of it as assuring that customers or users are truly active, that they haven't just given your product a cursory once-over and then lost interest. It might seem to make better sense to just consider this as part of the activation process, but the distinction is meaningful. For many products, solidifying the appreciation of value of a product or service requires new customers returning for an additional experience with it a certain number of times within a certain time period. For example, Pinterest might determine from analysis of user data that if a new user doesn't return to the site at least 3 times within the first 2 weeks after signing up, they are highly likely to abandon use. This means that the growth team would want to work intensely on getting them back that minimum number of times within that time frame. And anyone who has signed up for Pinterest will find that the company is indeed vigorous in encouraging return visits beginning right after initial signup. Once new users have crossed the threshold of initial retention, they move into the medium retention phase, a period when the interest in a product's novelty often fades. The core mission for growth teams in retaining users who are in this midterm phase is to make using a product a habit, working to create such a sense of satisfaction from the product or service that over time, users don't need to be prodded to use it again because they have incorporated the use of the product into their routine. Think of the Snapchat user who constantly checks her friend's stories while having breakfast and again after dinner. Or the Amazon shopper who always thinks of searching there first for any given product he's looking for. No prodding required. In the coming sections, we'll introduce a little about the psychology of habit formation, and then introduce tactics growth teams can employ for increasing the number of initially retained users who become habitual ones. Then, we'll move on to the tactics for long-term retention. This is the phase in which growth teams can help to assure that a product keeps offering customers more value. Teams must experiment with ways to keep improving the product, helping product development teams to determine the timing for introducing enhancements of existing features or entirely new features. The key here is to keep refreshing the customer's perception of the product as a must-have. What does good retention look like? Before we get into the specifics of how to improve retention in each of these phases, It's important to discuss the data that growth teams must be tracking and how they should be parsing it in order to find opportunities for hacks to try. First, different companies will want to measure their retention rate in different ways.